I'm Susan Moran. This is How on Earth, the KGNU Science Show. Today is Tuesday, April 16th, 2024. Coming up, we'll discuss the science and the mystery of end-of-life visions, also called deathbed visions, with Dr. Christopher Kerr.
There's no interpretation, there's no metaphor, they're not weird like dreams are. If you've lost your child and you see your child, that just is what it is. And very little tends to be said. There's no great epiphanies or pronouncements, but they just seem to understand the meaning of it because it's based in a relationship that actually was.
You're listening to How on Earth, the KGNU Science Show. I'm Susan Moran. You may be among the many people who know a loved one who, not long before dying, shared typically very loving, positive visions or dreams, including of reuniting with someone they loved who had died before them. So what can science tell us or not tell us about these mysterious and very common experiences at the threshold of life and death? And how do these visions affect the people who have them? My guest today is Dr. Chris Kerr. He's Chief Medical Officer and Chief Executive Officer of Hospice and Palliative Care Buffalo. That's in Buffalo, New York. And he has a PhD in neurobiology. Before gravitating to bedside patient care, he did extensive research on end-of-life visions among patients. Dr. Kerr is also the author of a 2020 book called Death is But a Dream: Finding Life and Meaning in End-of-Life Dreams. He was featured in a recent New York Times Magazine article on this topic by journalist Phoebe Zerwick. Dr. Kerr, welcome to the show. So glad to have you.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So I want to start with having you define what these so-called deathbed or end-of-life visions are.
Sure. These are the kind of subjective or inner experiences that people report as they approach end of life, and they're very distinct from normal dreams, and they're not confusional states. They're unique to this period in life.
So not confusional states. They're not hallucinations?
No, it's very important. I mean, they're often being medically dismissed because delirium or confusion is common at end of life. And what we did in our study is not only film patients, but we screen them every day before interviewing them for issue of confusion. And they couldn't participate. These are university-approved studies, and you had to be clear cognitively to participate. Patients sound like you and I.
And to be clear, like, it could be actually literally on deathbed or even weeks before, but as one is in the process of dying, is it knowing or unknowingly?
Yeah, it seems rather unknowingly. It usually starts a couple of weeks before death. And what we did is we followed people every day with a standardized interview, and we found that the frequency went up dramatically as they approached death. And what was interesting, when we looked at content, what we saw that most commonly, the theme that emerged is seeing people who loved you and who had passed themselves. And when they rated it on a comfort scale, that was associated with the highest degree of comfort.
Interesting. And what about those who might have very scary dreams or visions at the end? Or are they? Go ahead.
That was about 12%, and what we got wrong was the patient could tick off whether they were comforting, discomforting, or neither, but the discomforting ones were often the most transformational. So you die as you live, and we've all been hurt, harmed, and lost for having lived, and end of life doesn't change that reality. So it often, there are dreams that have discomforting things, but they're profoundly meaningful in very healing ways. So a mother whose child might be in prison for drug-related offenses, and she's wondering about her her worth or her meaning as a mother. In her end of life, her parents come to her, tell her what a good parent she was and that she's loved. So it's these wounds sort of get healed. Mothers who had lost children are reacquainted. So the theme may have distressing elements or background, but they're also very healing.
Interesting. And before I ask you a lot more about sort of the methodology and the effect on those patients, and for that matter, others, I want to ask you personally, you have quite a connection that got you interested in this to begin with, even before you started to migrate towards palliative care, right?
Yeah. I wouldn't say an interest. I had an aversion, and I ended up confronted with it. Yes, yes. Yeah.
And what happened? Was this your father at his deathbed?
Yeah, very quickly. I was 12, and I'm from Canada, and we would always go fishing. And the last time I saw him, he was telling me that we had to hurry to get on the plane to go up north where we'd go. And that was the last time I saw him. And I never really spoke about it. And I didn't mean to go into this work. I was actually a cardiology fellow just moonlighting on the side at a hospice. But I was confronted by what I had seen in my childhood. And I didn't have a particular interest in it. To be honest with you, I found it quite unsettling.
You mean found it unsettling that, like in the case your father had these particular visions?
Yeah,
or just death itself?
Yeah, and I guess I'm just not that way inclined. It's easier to sit within the science of medicine and be grounded in things you know and can image and measure, etc. And so this is kind of going into a space that I wasn't really, built for. But what drew me was it was clearly so therapeutic to the patient. So I ended up at this very odd place where I didn't understand it, but I don't think that was really what mattered. What mattered was that my patients did. And then I was trying to teach it, and, we live in an evidence-based time, and inevitably the young doctor would say, well, there's no evidence for this. So that's why we did the studies, was just to really give some validation to what we clearly understood. And if you talk to nurses who care for patients, particularly towards the end of life, there's nothing new in this, and it's across cultures. It's always been discussed throughout history. It's more something that has been known but lost in our Western model of medicine.
So fascinating. First, I just want to get more of a picture of actually what your father was seeing.
What he was seeing is that if you've seen people at the end of their life, they kind of have a foot in two worlds. They'll have their eyes open, but they're clearly visualizing something very different. It's an unshared reality. And so he was seeing that, in his mind, his last day on Earth, he was in this very securing and warm place where we were together and we were going on a trip. So he was reaching for my shirt, thinking he was doing up my jacket and telling me we had to get ready to get onto the plane because we were going somewhere.
Wow.
So actually what had happened was the priest came behind me and took me out of the room because you often try to protect children, well-intended, but not so well-intended. Mm-hmm. But I just knew intuitively that he was in an okay place because that's what we all end up when we're looking at someone we love in the bed at the end of their life is where are they and how are they?
Absolutely. I can relate. I'm sure so many can. I mean, when my father, I think 3 days before he died, he was not on his deathbed, but he was actually in memory care at a facility and shared with a sister of mine that, I'm visiting Jackie, who's my mom, and it's wonderful. And then, boom. So we were just so curious about, is it wishful thinking? Is it what? Which brings me to ask you, what influence do pain-killing drugs, opioids like morphine that are given to many hospice patients at end of life, have on these deathbed visions?
It's most of people who are on opioids, they're on a gradual graded dose that they tolerate well. More commonly, they're given drugs for anxiety or confusion that can dampen. And that's one of our concerns, if this is misunderstood, people may be medicated and essentially sterilized from their own dying process. Mm-hmm. And we do see that. So they'll come from the hospital, and they've been medicated, unfortunately. Because, you know, I mean, the point is that people don't stop living because they're dying, and there's actually profound living and insight. Mm. We did a study that looked at whether there was growth and understanding, and people who are having these experiences absolutely did right until the very last days of dying. With the overall theme being that their life is very much affirmed, they're kind of put back together with those they loved and lost, and fear seems to dissipate.
Interesting. And now more on the methodology. So this research that you, and I've seen some of the studies that others have done as well, I mean, you can't do brain scans, right? So like, how would you even know the difference between whether it's opioid influenced or...
Oh,
not,
because we control for the drugs. So we don't take, we absolutely knew what people were on. They were either on it forever. You have to understand, some of these people were living alone, highly functional. And you can really see that in the videos. That's why we did the videos, because you can tell and so clearly. So many people are on nothing. Mm-hmm. I mean, they don't have disease involving their brain. You know, it could be their kidney. It doesn't, or their colon, it doesn't necessarily have a metabolic effect. But if you see the videos, you can tell clearly that they're fully intact. But we did measure things like drugs.
And then is this all interview based, or there's some blood tests? I mean, again, there are no brain scans, right?
We would do labs on people to make sure there wasn't, you know, electrolyte abnormalities or infections. We controlled for all the things you would normally look for to make sure somebody was. But they were, standardized questionnaires, so everyone got the same kind of questionnaire, and then some open interviews, and again, videoed so you can see it, because we all have this assumption that the dying are feeble-minded and confused. And so the videos become very important. And we included children.
Interesting. And do you know, or is it known that there could be, I guess, what you call a positivity bias? I mean, like you alluded to before, we all want to make sense of our life and die feeling it has rich meaning, that our lives have had that. So are some people sometimes intentionally or not, or consciously or not consciously saying, I saw mom, I saw, you know, all my relatives? And how do you know if they did or didn't?
You know, it's hard. We'll never know. You would actually think the opposite, because most people you would think would go into a dying process with fear and apprehension, just the unknown, right? The dread of saying goodbye, anticipation of pain, all those things, and what they come to us from their dying experience and tell us something that's very positive and life affirming. So I think the bias would be the other way around. The other thing is, so much of this is occurring in sleep. We actually, in our surveys, we asked them to measure the reality of this. So is this feel real, 0 to 10, and 10 being the most real? And the most common number we see is 10. And we published, I think, 7 or 8 papers now, almost 1,500 patients and families we've included in our various studies.
The same 1,500, or do you mean each study? Because these are...
Each study has different study set, but in aggregate, we've looked at about 1,500 patients and families. And it's just so obvious, it's so predictable, and it's been replicated now in other countries and cultures.
So fascinating. And then how do these visions and dreams affect, well, the outlook short-term? I guess there's probably not much of a long-term outlook for these people, because you alluded before that really they provide comfort and meaning. I mean, is there more, or is that basically the most common message?
Yeah, I think what it does is they feel, the best way to describe it is they feel more whole, more put back together.
You're listening to How on Earth, the KGNU Science Show. I'm Susan Moran. My guest today is Dr. Chris Kerr. He's Chief Medical Officer and Chief Executive Officer of Hospice and Palliative Care Buffalo. That's in Buffalo, New York. And he has a PhD in neurobiology, Before gravitating to bedside patient care, he did extensive research on end-of-life visions among patients. Dr. Kerr is also the author of a 2020 book called Death is But a Dream, Finding Life and Meaning in End-of-Life Dreams. He was featured in a recent New York Times Magazine article on this topic by journalist Phoebe Zerwick.
So you'll have a man who's 95, and he may have lost his mother when he was 5. But, you know, when he hears her voice and smells her perfume, they're often recalling their life's greatest accomplishments, which is their relationships. But they're done in such a vivid way that it feels like it was experienced. They're often very angry when you refer to it as a dream. They refer to it as a happening. Like that was virtual for them. And, you know, what's interesting is you don't need, there's no interpretation, there's no metaphor, they're not weird like dreams are. If you've lost your child and you see your child, that just is what it is. And very little tends to be said. There's no great epiphanies or pronouncements, but they just seem to understand the meaning of it because it's based in a relationship that actually was. So they feel they don't feel alone, and their children will say that, I don't feel alone. They feel loved. And in this process, just we don't hear reports of fear. It's quite the opposite. And the videos are striking that way. The overarching theme is this, they're talking about things that are very positive and not fear-based.
And I know you've and others have done research, understandably, on a particular subset of patients, of people who are close to death from some illness. So clearly it seems this does not apply, or at least maybe has not been measured, among those who are murdered or who commit suicide. Obviously,
yeah,
the latter is more of a negative.
Yeah, it we'll never know. There's no real good way. It's interesting, though, you know, the expression, my life flashed before my eyes.
Sure.
There's some sense of review. And I think even in relatively, you know, acute death, the people still reflect, you know, it draws you to a different vantage point. So even like George Floyd, when he was dying, you know, do you remember what he was saying?
Mother, right? Mom.
Yeah, calling for his mother. And that's the same thing they report in battlefields.
Well, that might not be a vision. So, that could be clearly a desperate desire.
You're right. But the psychological point is, from the perspective is, that they're drawn to the thing that defined who they were, or how they were, you know, secured. It's very interesting. The people that are often cited, they focus on the people who love them unconditionally, and so that may be one parent, but not the other. Three siblings, but not the other two. It's fascinating that there's this editing process that seems to go on, and that they tend not to be drawn to the negative, but to the positive.
Boy, it seems there's so much of life teaching for all of us, on deathbed or not. Like, what sort of, I don't know, messages or teachings or experiences do you find that the loved ones who remain behind have?
Well, it's a great question. We've done two studies with about 750 families, bereaved families. And it's remarkable how people leave us matters. It matters on how we recall them, how we grieve. And we've actually looked at bereavement scales, and people who see this grieve differently in more healthy ways. A lot of these people are on video, and they're remarkable. So, you know, two couples have been married together for 60, 70 years, and they lost a child together, and the one looks at their life partner and they're holding that child, then death is no longer empty. It's rich, and so it, you know, so much of dying is defined in medical terms as organ failure.
So true.
And those sort of things, but it's really a closing of a life. And that's, again, is defined by our relationship, not by parts that are gone wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's, if you think about it, dying is this vantage point that it's understandable that you reflect, and you remember and you recall. Mm-hmm. And thankfully, it usually focuses on the best parts of having lived. So it does matter to the bereaved enormously. To parents of children, you know, we've published those studies, and when they can say that they're not alone and they're loved, then your fear for them changes. It inverts the whole, our notion of it.
Yeah. I sing in a threshold choir, and we sing for families, mainly patients who are on their deathbed or close to it. And it's very much, I hear over and over, particularly from the hospice nurses, as you well know, like, you are not alone. We are here. Let go. You know, those are really important kind of messages, whether or not the dying are having these visions or not.
Yeah, very, very much. That needs to be the what's relayed, absolutely.
And then there's always going to be this mystery. Like, this is a science show. I'm wanting to know, okay, what are the scientific underpinnings, you know, the methodologies, the effects? And it brings me to, there was a passage in the recent New York Times Magazine article by the journalist Phoebe Zerwick, featuring you quite prominently. And she said something like that she had spoken to you often about the, quote, contradiction between medicine's demand for evidence and the ineffable quality of your patients' experiences. Like, do you really care? I mean, you are a scientist after all, and an MD, but that there's medical or scientific evidence for all this?
No, and I think that's one of the tragedies of modern medicine, is that there's both a science and an art to medicine. The science has so outpaced the art, and we're so enamored by things like technology, that we've obscured the humanistic elements of it. And if, again, we can't make it an objective evidence for something, we discard it. Yet, you know, if you ask anybody, does love exist? You say, yes, I feel love. I know love. Well, where is it? And I just think we've lost reverence for things that are essentially spiritual-based, that actually matter more to the dying patients than their renal function. They don't experience that. You know, they don't live their life as an amalgamation of pieces. But we're so drawn to what we can do to somebody that we don't do enough of just sitting back and being present, and instead of really asking them, what's your experience? Are you okay in there?
Like, not try to fix it.
We all get pain. We all get physical pain, which is actually way overemphasized in actuality. But we don't have enough appreciation for what the subjective experience is of the person in the bed.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. That was Dr. Chris Kerr. He's Chief Medical Officer and Chief Executive Officer of Hospice and Palliative Care Buffalo. That's in Buffalo, New York. And he has a PhD in neurobiology. Before gravitating to bedside patient care, he did extensive research on end-of-life visions among patients. Dr. Kerr is also the author of a 2020 book called Death is But a Dream: Finding Life and Meaning in End-of-Life Dreams. He was featured in a recent New York Times Magazine article on this topic by journalist Phoebe Zerwick. Dr. Kerr, thank you so much for coming on the show.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That's all for this edition of How on Earth. Our executive producer is Shelley Schlender. This week's show was produced by me, Susan Moran, and Shelley Schlender. Our theme music was written and produced by Josh Cutler. Additional music from Moon Over Mountains Threshold Choir. Visit our website on howonearth.org to find past episodes, extended interviews, and you can subscribe to our podcast through iTunes and follow us on Facebook and X. Questions or comments, call the KGNU comment line at 303-447-9911. For How on Earth, the KGNU Science Show, I'm Susan Moran.